Good morning. China's president hosts a summit for Eurasian leaders that includes one the U.S. has lately been pushing away, India's Narendra Modi. What are the risks for the United States? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. It's the first Labor Day of President Trump's second term. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Wages are rising. Unemployment is low. So why is the head of one union unhappy? He says canceled projects affect union jobs. Also, how did music critics go from sour to polite? One music writer explores the factors that cause many people not to say what's on their minds. It's Monday, September 1st. 40 years ago today, researchers found the wreck of the Titanic, although they did not find the heart of the ocean. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The Trump administration is preparing to ramp up immigration enforcement in Chicago and possibly other U.S. cities. Speaking on CBS, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem defended the agency's decision to expand federal deployments.
I'd encourage every single big city, San Francisco, Boston, Chicago, whatever they are, if they want to help make their city safer, more prosperous, allow people the opportunity to walk in freedom like the people of Washington, D.C. are now, and enjoying going out to eat at night and not having to worry if they're going to be a victim of a carjacking or a robbery, they should call us.
Her comments came a day after the mayor of Chicago signed an executive order directing the city's legal team to explore ways to push back on a potential influx of federal law enforcement and National Guard troops in the city. Search and rescue operations are continuing across eastern Afghanistan after a powerful magnitude 6.0 earthquake struck the region. Omkar Kandikar reports the Taliban say at least 800 people have died and more than 2,500 others were injured.
The earthquake hit the remote Kunar province around midnight, burying several people living in mud and stone houses in the mountain villages. Videos reviewed by NPR showed a helicopter evacuating the affected areas and residents helping soldiers and medics carry the wounded to ambulances. A health department spokesperson said rescue teams from Kabul, which is around 100 miles away, have reached the affected areas. A disaster management officer said they are looking to international NGOs for help. This is the second deadliest earthquake in Afghanistan since 2023, which had killed thousands in the country's west at the time. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Mumbai.
Lawmakers are back on Capitol Hill this week after an August recess that was marked by voter frustration. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports many constituents are voicing concerns over the economy and other hot-button issues.
Voters at town halls across the country raised alarm over a faltering economy putting the squeeze on American families. Lawmakers faced blowback from constituents to address rising prices, fueled in part by President Trump's tariffs, and concerns that changes at the Federal Reserve could put further strain on the economy. Many also pushed back on Trump's signature bill passed this summer, concerned about cuts to Medicaid and other government spending. However, the hardest job on tap for lawmakers may be averting a government shutdown tied to a September 30th deadline. Both parties are deeply divided, and it's unclear if they can reach a deal. Claudia Rizales, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. President Trump says he plans to sign an executive order this week requiring every voter to show identification. He says it would severely restrict mail-in voting, with exceptions for people who are very ill and members of the military. But federal elections are run by state and local officials, and it's unclear whether the president has the constitutional authority to enforce such a rule. Democrats are hoping to win back control of Congress after next year's midterm elections. A widely anticipated rematch is happening today in Flushing Meadows. NPR's Amy Held reports tennis stars Coco Gauff and Naomi Osaka are set to play in the fourth round of the U.S. Open.
She's like the main star of the U.S. Open.
That's four-time major title winner Naomi Osaka talking about her opponent today, Coco Gauff. 6 years after, Osaka beat Gauff, but perhaps more memorable was what Osaka did afterward. consoling a tearful Goff who was just 15 and inviting her to speak. It was a demonstration of solidarity between black women in a sport where they are often underrepresented. The U.S. Tennis Association says overall black participation is growing, up 25% in recent years. Venus Williams, the first black woman to be ranked world number one in the open era more than two decades ago, says everyone will be watching today.
And that's what tennis needs.
Goff is also anticipating it.
It would be a cool kind of a deja vu type of situation, but hopefully it'll be a different result.
At stake, a spot in the quarterfinal. Amy Held, NPR News.
I'm Windsor Johnston, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
Some of us Minnesotans like to think we're tough for surviving the long winters here. Well, it turns out it's not just Minnesota's people that are hardy. Our apples are, too. Here's Kate Roberts, author of the book Minnesota 150.
The Honeycrisp was introduced to the public in 1991, the result of at least a decade of research from the University of Minnesota's fruit breeding program, and particularly a professor named Jim Luby, who wanted to produce an apple that could stand up to Minnesota weather, but would also taste really good.
And it does taste good. It's slightly tart, slightly sweet. But the real clincher is the...
It has unusually large cells, which makes it super crunchy and which also makes it able to stay in your refrigerator for months at a time.
All reasons why the Honeycrisp is our state apple. But it's not the only apple the U has developed.
The Zestar is one of the more recent varieties. There's also a Snow Sweet. Each one is specifically designed to be grown by people here in the Midwest. And so as a result, apple growing is big business here. Every tree each year can put $1,000 in the pocket of its grower. That's real money for people dealing with a relatively short growing season.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Today, China's president is hosting leaders from across Eurasia.
Those attending include Russia's leader, an adversary of the United States, and also the Prime Minister of India, a nation the U.S. has cultivated for many years as a friend. Lately, though, the Trump administration has been pushing India away. So how might China take advantage?
NPR international correspondent Dia Hadid is following this story. Hi there, Dia.
Hi, Steve.
Okay, so what's the context of this summit?
The context appears to be Trump's remaking of foreign policy, which has felt pretty unpredictable for much of the world, like tariffs on friends, the European Union and India, initial hostility to Ukraine, now peace talks. So since 2001, China's sought to align Asian nations and former Soviet countries, in part through this grouping called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
Okay.
It's happened in fits and starts, though, but this summit appears to be the most important. It's certainly the largest, and it may well be because China sees an opening.
Do you mean an opening to lure American friends and allies more closely to China?
Yes, although we can't see any tangibles so far from the summit, but it may well be that the optics right now are the most important thing. President Xi has used his platform to denounce bullying behavior. He's made a point about the world not just having one superpower. He's offered millions of dollars of aid and loans to member countries. And consider the picture. All these leaders are gathering around Xi because they may well like to improve relations with China as insurance. And most important of them all is India.
Why would India need as insurance to be a little bit closer to its neighbor and sometimes enemy, China?
Because President Trump's second administration has blown apart decades of bipartisan policy that brought India closer as a way of forming a bulwark against China. Mm. He's damaged those relations, analysts tell us, by imposing 50% tariffs on many exports and ostensibly punishment for India being a major buyer of Russian oil. And nearly every day, Trump's administration insult India or its leader. Most recently, trade advisor Peter Navarro described India as a laundromat for the Kremlin on Fox News.
Okay, so, I mean, I get the complaint. India has been buying Russian oil. The United States would rather that that stop. And there's also this kind of personal beef between the prime minister and the president. But is India actually getting closer to China as a result?
This is interesting because China and India, remember, they're neighbors. They share a border of over 2,000 miles through the Himalayas, although that border, where it should lie, remains in dispute. It's a fundamental tension between them and it remains unresolved. And there were some tangibles that happened before this meeting, but nothing at the summit. And that's perhaps a sign. Analysts tell us, look at the group picture. There's China's Xi, and then to his right, the leader of Kazakhstan, and then Modi. None of this is an accident. This is visual language to indicate that India comes to this meeting as being more vulnerable. Like, on this, I spoke to Siddharth Ramani. He's a fellow at the Council for Strategic and Defence Research. It's based in New Delhi. And he says, look, a weakened India may well strengthen China's hand vis-a-vis the United States.
If the US is still intent on balancing China, it could be underestimating the ways in which this present disruption could force India towards a relationship with China.
A relationship with China that is fundamentally unequal and has been made more unequal, he says, by Trump's tariffs and this daily browbeating. And effectively, he says, one way you can understand President Xi hosting this massive summit is that America has actually strengthened Beijing's hand in the world.
NPR's Dia Hadid, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Steve.
China's summit comes just a few days after a federal appeals court ruled that Trump's Liberation Day tariffs are unlawful. The judges allowed the tariffs to remain in effect until at least mid-October in anticipation of the administration appealing to the Supreme Court. So how much of a factor are those import taxes, plus even higher tariffs because of India buying Russian oil, in reshaping India's foreign policy? Joining us now to discuss is economist Devashish Mitra. He's a professor at Syracuse University and specializes in international trade and the Indian economy. Good morning, and thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Leila. Good morning.
How significant are these U.S. tariffs totaling 50% for India's economy?
They're very significant because the estimates are that it will shave off about 1% of India's GDP. The projected growth rate was about 6.5% for next year. It could go down to about 5.5% or even lower as a result of the tariff. So they are pretty significant for India. India exports a lot of labor-intensive manufacturers like apparel, textiles, footwear, jewelry, etc., to the United States. On the other hand, India's main exports to the U.S. are services, and services don't get impacted by these tariffs, and it's very difficult to put tariffs on services. But on the other hand, it's quite likely that President Trump will restrict H-1B visas and other temporary work visas on which services exports rely. So this is pretty significant.
And how are they being received? I mean, does India have any leverage to push back against the tariffs?
So India has had a huge geopolitical importance within the region. Mm-hmm. India has a population of 1.4 billion, and it's a large democracy next to China, which has a similar population, a bigger economy, but is not a democracy. So India was, one of U.S.'s strong allies in the region and was a counter to China. So it's going to make a huge difference.
So could these tariffs shift those alliances and that dynamic?
Could the
Because India has historically tried to...
I think the tariffs have already started pushing India towards China. And, you know, there have been statements made on both sides that... So, for example, China's ambassador said that China opposes Washington's steep tariffs on India and will firmly stand with India. Prime Minister Modi is visiting India for the first, visiting China for the first time in 7 years, and going to this, and he is at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit, which is of huge significance. You have President Xi there, but also President Putin, who's there, you know, Iran's head of state is there, and lots of other high-profile leaders are attending the summit. So I think, the fact that this is happening, you know, Prime Minister Modi is visiting India for the first time in 7 years is pretty significant.
And as you mentioned, the size of India's population and its relationship historically with the U.S., mm-hmm. It was seen, India was seen or considered a counterweight to China in Asia.
Yes.
After what you just described, I mean, does that still hold true?
No, it doesn't hold true because India is being, India feels singled out now. India has been, basically, there's an extra 25% tariff, 25 plus 25. It makes it 50, and that extra 25% tariff is because they're saying it's because India is buying Russian oil, and they're putting pressure on India not to buy Russian oil. But there are many other countries that buy Russian oil. China buys more Russian oil, and then the U.S. buys uranium, palladium, and fertilizers.
Unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there. Devashish Mitra is an economics professor at Syracuse University. Thank you for your time and your insights.
Thank you.
In other tariff news, fans of Korean skincare products are taking inventory after a frenzy of placing online orders from international retailers. The de minimis tariff exemption that used to apply to small shipments from abroad ended on Friday. Yes, an appeals court and a lower court have both found the president exceeded his authority by constantly changing import taxes on his own, but that ruling is on hold until the Supreme Court speaks. For member station KCRW, Megan Jamerson reports.
Last week, TikTok was full of posts from people like Tiffany Chow, who were racing to stock up on their favorite skincare products from South Korea-based online retailers like Olive Young.
I cannot live without my Korean or Japanese sunscreen. I placed a huge skincare haul with Olive Young.
Korean skincare products have a cult following, in part because of how cheap they are compared to other high-quality products. According to the U.S. International Trade Commission, the U.S. imported $1.7 billion worth of South Korean cosmetics in 2024. Before last Friday, when you placed an order from South Korea, it was exempt from tariffs if it was under $800. Now those packages will be subject to either a tariff of 15% or a flat fee of $80 per package. That means your $16 tube of sunscreen got a lot more expensive.
It would take the several months to see the full impact.
That's Moonsop Lee. He's an economics professor at UC San Diego who specializes in the Korean economy. He says if people don't find a product they love in the U.S., they may be willing to pay the higher prices.
Korean skincare products have so unique features, and it's also quite popular, I mean, partly because of the huge popularity in the K-pop culture.
There are some retailers in the U.S. that sell these products. Many couldn't take advantage of de minimis because they order in bulk, but they were already dealing with tariffs that went into effect in August. Vanessa Nebhani owns a Korean skincare shop in Pasadena, California, called Playlab Beauty. She stocked up on Korean sunscreen before the tariff. She hasn't raised her prices yet.
When people are, you know, standing in our store with their phones out, price comparing against, you know, Amazon or Olive Young or whatever it is, that extra dollar matters.
But as a small business owner, she can only eat the cost of tariffs for so long. For NPR News, I'm Megan Jamerson in Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
Join us for the 5th Annual Grand Rapids River Fest, Saturday, September 6th, presented by KAXE, the City of Grand Rapids, and sponsored by Grand Rapids State Bank. The lineup features Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Come along for a day of great music along the banks of the Mississippi River. Tickets available now at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
Next Fresh Air, we conclude our archive series R&B, Rockabilly, and Early Rock and Roll with Dion, who brought his guitar and sang some songs. Also, songwriter, pianist, arranger, and producer Alan Toussaint, who was at the piano for our 1988 interview and sang some of his early songs, including Lipstick Traces. Join us.
I hug them and I squeeze them. They don't even know my name. They call me the Wanderer.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people, money, and agents today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Here's an irony of this moment. Some people say the most extreme, outrageous things, and other people feel they can't really say what they think. Apparently, the people feeling silenced even includes music critics. Music is a subject on which the music writer Kelly Fasane says there's plenty of room for disagreement.
I always get annoyed when people say that music brings us together because one of the things it can do is give us ways to differentiate ourselves.
Sane wrote a little history of music criticism in The New Yorker. He says critics lost their edge when compared with critics of the 1960s and 70s.
There's this guy named Robert Christgau who called himself the Dean of American Rock Criticism, who literally gave letter grades to albums in the Village Voice. So Donny Hathaway, he described as, quote, supper club melodrama and homogenized jazz, and gave that album a D minus. George Harrison, Dark Horse, he called him a, quote, horse dork, C minus. There's this famous review in Rolling Stone by Grail Marcus of Bob Dylan's self-portrait album, which began, what is this?
My daddy, he made whiskey. My granddaddy, he did too.
So there was this idea that rock critics in particular were going to fight about music. We're going to have strong and fierce opinions. And to me, as a kid, as I started to read some of these older articles, that seemed like part of the fun.
Part of the story you tell is that people were entertained by these criticisms and maybe didn't take them entirely seriously. You could be a fan of George Harrison and read the horrible review of George Harrison and still kind of enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, in pro wrestling, they call it kayfabe, right? The idea that you're kind of staying in character and that the audience likes a good fight. And also, there was this idea that, well, rock and roll was this newish music that was kind of rude, so the critics were going to be kind of rude, too.
Well, what then began to happen as the years went on to music criticism?
There was this idea, I wrote about it in 2004, of this thing called rockism. The idea that critics were maybe a little too devoted to some of the myths of rock and roll, and they were missing some other kinds of music. They were maybe not listening carefully enough to pop music or R&B or country music. And people started to talk about something called poptimism. The idea was instead of being rockist, instead of being focused on loud guitars and sweaty guys in leather jackets, we were going to maybe celebrate pop music. And so instead of saying, oh, this boy band is just a bunch of sellouts making music to make money, they said, no, actually, this hit single is pretty good. And that movement became increasingly influential in music criticism.
I'm realizing that one of the things you're describing then is what was happening in the broader society. Instead of having one narrative, one set of values, we become more multicultural and people aren't so sure of their values and try to understand other people's points of view.
That's exactly right. I mean, anyone who has this weird job of being a music critic faces people who ask them, who the hell are you to tell me what music to like? And that's a reasonable feeling to have, but it can be kind of fatal to the enterprise of criticism.
Was there another factor here? Social media gave fans the ability to push back on critics.
Well, yeah, fans didn't used to really have a voice, right? Musicians would make the records, critics would say what they thought, and that was kind of the end of it. But with social media, the conversation started to go in all sorts of different directions.
Look what you made me do.
Taylor Swift is in the news the last few days, in case you missed it. What role did Taylor Swift play in this transition?
Well, Taylor Swift was someone, on the one hand, whose fans were and are ferocious. And critics sometimes complained that if they said something negative about Taylor Swift, they got reprisals from her fans. At one point, the magazine Paste published a review of the Taylor Swift album, Tortured Poets. And the review was kind of negative, and it was published without a byline. And the idea was that this would maybe help keep the critic safe from any backlash from Taylor Swift's fans.
Witness protection program, okay.
Exactly right. The critic with a brown paper bag over her head. And, you know, it's kind of funny, but it's a real sense of the pressure that critics sometimes felt.
I feel that you've again touched on broader trends in society. We have raised the cost of inconvenient or impolite speech.
Yes, and while also giving people more freedom. One of the things I noticed was that sometimes it seemed like the really harsh reviews of albums were coming from everyday users online, on social media. And then when you read a professional critic, you'd read something more thoughtful, more polite.
What's an example of what you're talking about?
One example is the singer Lorde put out a record in 2021 called Solar Power. And it got polite reviews. Rolling Stone gave it 3.5 stars.
My cheeks in that color, overripe peaches. No shirt, no shoes, only my features. My boy behind me, he's taking pictures.
In fact, one of the most negative reviews of the album came from Lorde herself. Later in an interview, she said that the album was her attempt to be chill and kind of wafty, and she remembers thinking, actually, I don't think this is me. So you had this bizarre situation where professional critics were kinder to Lorde than she herself was. You sometimes hear it said that an artist is her own worst critic, but I don't think we want that to be literally true.
Why, if at all, does it matter if criticism has become much more polite?
You're asking a slightly more polite version of the question, who cares? One answer is that for some of us, it's fun to read slightly unhinged criticism. And it reflects something true about what it's like to be a person to listen to music. If you're talking to your friend about music, you'll probably hear some extremely strong and categorical opinions, right? Whether it's, I hate metal, whether it's hip hop hasn't been good since 2005. Mm-hmm. People tend to have really strong views. So I get a little skeptical when the critical reviews don't seem that strong. If we can't have a frank exchange of views about Taylor Swift, maybe we're losing our ability a little bit to have frank exchanges of views about everything else.
Khalif Hassani writes for The New Yorker. His latest article is called How Music Criticism Lost Its Edge. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's NPR News.
Soul singer Kirby has toured with John Legend and Leon Bridges, written songs that have appeared on hit TV shows, and has more than 1 million TikTok followers. But she didn't build her career by saying yes to everything.
Sometimes it feels like I'm a slow cooker on the stove, honey, but the season and everything is going to be just right.
Kirby on her new album, Miss Black America, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered KAXE. Your local host will be Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 529. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. Mostly sunny today, highs in the upper 70s. Slight chance for showers this afternoon. Tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the upper 50s. Again, slight chance for showers and thunderstorms. For tomorrow, about a 50% chance of showers, partly sunny, highs in the upper 60s to low 70s. Wishing you a happy Labor Day today. The Cloquet Labor Day Parade is happening at 11 a.m. on Cloquet Avenue from 18th to 8th Streets. There's also a car show from 10 to 3 at Dunlap Island. Happy Dancing Turtle near Pine River invites 4- and 5-year-olds to participate in the Tiny Turtles program this fall. Classes begin Monday, September 8th and continue twice a month through November. Classes are held entirely outdoors. Find more info at happydancingturtle.org. You can also listen to a conversation we had with Michelle Hoffs from Happy Dancing Turtle. That is at our website, kaxc.org. Ripple River Gallery, south of Deerwood, hosts the dual exhibit Reclaimed, Reframed, now through September 28th, featuring sculptures from KAXC's own John Bauer, paired with photographs from Rachel Kane. The exhibit proves that one person's trash is another person's treasure. Open Wednesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, Sundays, 11 to 4. We want to hear about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. Also find events up north every week at kaxc.org. It's a list of happenings throughout the area with links to pertinent information. Coming up at 9 o'clock this morning, we have an episode of Ham Radio for you. It is all about the abundance of gardens, perfect for this time of year, preserving summer through memories, recipes, and community. Here's John Latimer with our daily phenology.
On this date, September 1st, 1999, I noted what I hoped were the last of the horseflies. Horseflies are large, brown, biting flies that have jaws that work like two knives slicing back and forth, sort of perpendicular to their body alignment, and those slicing mouth parts cut open your skin, and then the fly proceeds to lap up the blood. Now, she needs the blood as a means of making her eggs. She needs the protein from the blood to make the eggs that are going to be next year's horseflies. And so I hate to give them any of my blood, if at all possible. And this late in September marks what I always hope for as the last of the horseflies.
In Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sattva, committed to making handcrafted mattresses that help lull people to sleep and keep them sleeping soundly. More information is at SAATVA.com/NPR. From Visit St. Pete, Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at VisitSPC.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. This is President Trump's first Labor Day since his return to the White House.
Trump campaigned on the promise of providing America's workers with a renaissance. A little over 6 months in, how's that effort coming along?
NPR's Andrea Hsu covers labor. Hi there, Andrea.
Hi.
So what's the president saying about workers now?
Well, as you might expect, Steve, he says they're doing great. At a cabinet meeting last week, he said wages are rising, factories are booming, and he took credit for all of this.
Every policy of the Trump administration is designed to lift up the American worker, promote great-paying blue-collar jobs, and to rebuild the industrial bedrock of our nation.
Now, Steve, factories aren't exactly booming. They've been in a bit of a slump over the last few months, but wages have risen this year, as they have over the last several years. And most people who want jobs are working. The unemployment rate remains fairly low at just over 4%. But there is a lot of uncertainty right now, a lot of points of tension in different parts of the workforce. And if you're out and about today, you might hear about some of this at mass protests that have been organized all over the country in all 50 states. The theme is workers over billionaires.
What are the objections of the labor movement?
Well, immigration, for one. The Trump administration has been cracking down not only on people who are in the U.S. illegally, but also on those who had legal status through different humanitarian programs that Trump is now ending.
Oh, yeah.
And these new immigration policies are affecting workers, you know, everywhere on farms in rural America, in factories in the Midwest, in healthcare and hotels. Trump has claimed that immigrants are taking jobs from Americans, but in a lot of these industries, there aren't enough workers. So that's one issue I've heard about. But I'm also hearing from labor unions that represent blue-collar American workers, you know, those Trump courted during last year's presidential campaign.
And let's be clear, a lot of blue-collar union-type folks did vote for President Trump. But what
Absolutely.
Are their unions saying now?
Yeah, well, the unions are really worried that a lot of big infrastructure projects that got off the ground when Biden was president, that they are less of a sure thing. And this is especially true in the renewable energy space. I spoke with Brent Booker. He's the general president of the Laborers International Union of North America. And their members work in construction, you know, working on buildings and roads and bridges and clean energy projects. And here's how he described this moment.
It's chaos. It's uncertainty. It's unpredictability.
And Steve Booker is especially riled up right now about what's happened with a wind farm under construction off the coast of Rhode Island. It's called Revolution Wind. The Trump administration issued a stop work order on that project about 10 days ago.
Yeah, the president also spoke about that at great length in some of his public appearances this past week. What's going on here?
Yeah, well, Trump is no fan of windmills. He put a moratorium on new wind projects already, but the administration said it was pausing this project because of national security concerns, fear of drone strikes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Brent Booker, the union president, is furious about this. He said this project was approved long ago. 2 million hours of work have been completed.
Wow.
45 turbines already in the air, but now several hundred workers who were out over the water have been idled.
Not only does that affect the individuals who are working on that, but an entire industry now is, you know, what's going to happen? Who's going to invest right now in renewable energy? And that just takes away future jobs and future opportunities.
So that is his concern. It's the future. Right now, Brent Booker says most of his members are working, but he credits the last administration and the last Congress for that, for the federal incentives that jump-started those projects. With Trump, he doesn't like what he's seen so far, but he's still holding out hope that he will make good on his promises to workers.
A lot of uncertainty. Andrea, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
NPR's Andrea Hsu.
President Trump says restaurants in Washington, D.C. are, quote, busier than ever now that he has increased law enforcement and deployed the National Guard to patrol the city's streets. Here he is in the Oval Office 2 weeks ago.
Friends are calling me up, Democrats are calling me up, and they're saying, sir, I want to thank you. My wife and I went out to dinner last night for the first time in 4 years.
In 4 years? We sent NPR's Milton Gavada out to see how D.C. locals feel about going out on the town.
At Hill Prince, a neighborhood restaurant and bar, Chef Rock Harper makes a lavender fields.
It's a tequila cocktail with grapefruit, simple syrup, a lavender syrup.
Hill Prince is located along the district's 8th Street corridor, which is known for its nightlife. Harper says fewer people are coming by lately.
People think that, you know, there are checkpoints and DEA and FBI and National Guard on corners slamming people.
He worries the extra law enforcement and National Guard deployed around D.C. are making people hesitant to go out.
I've seen patrols, right? You'll see groups of four, six, or eight cops, MPD, DEA, FBI, National Guard, just walking, fully armed, bulletproof vest or whatever. So it's very shocking to an American.
In August, Trump declared a crime emergency, saying crime in D.C. was out of control. However, D.C. crime statistics from 2024 show that violent crime is at a 30-year low. Currently, 2,000 National Guard troops are patrolling the streets of the Capitol, and additional DEA, FBI, and ICE agents have also been deployed.
My folks are just trying to get through the next couple weeks.
That's Sean Townsend. He's president and CEO of the Restaurant Association of Metropolitan Washington, a trade group that represents about 1,500 restaurants.
We're already struggling with the increase in labor costs to their businesses and rent control. Food supply chain is not what it used to be. It just costs more to operate a business.
August is typically a slow month for restaurants, but according to the restaurant booking company OpenTable, compared to the same time last year, reservations dipped 31% the week President Trump announced he was deploying extra security. Sofina Odero, an educator, has been avoiding going out so she doesn't encounter National Guard. She says they make her feel tense.
I'm finding myself more open to meeting friends at their own homes and their own spaces and having cooking at home mostly.
However, some locals feel safer, like political consultant Rick Van Meter.
I rode the Metro today for the first time in 3 months, and I was just very pleasantly surprised at how safe it felt, how clean it felt.
He was going out to dinner in D.C.'s upscale Georgetown neighborhood with his wife, Whitney Van Meter, who is also a political consultant. She says she feels more confident going out.
For the first time, I feel comfortable parking my car in Georgetown as it gets darker because I'm not so worried about my car getting broken into.
She agrees with Trump's idea to send National Guard troops to Baltimore, Chicago, and New York.
You want to open a tab, my friend?
Back at Hill Prince, on the other side of town, Chef Harper sees it differently. This is a scary time, he says, not just for D.C., but for the country. So on this night, he's especially glad to see people drifting into his bar. The evening, he says, is looking up.
Can I get two shots of tequila and a watermelon tajito?
I love it. What kind of tequila?
Milton Cavada, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
Coming up September 6th, we are so excited for Grand Rapids River Fest. Opening up will be Alan Sparhawk, who recently talked with Kari Hedlund about his new album with Trampled by Turtles.
I remember at the time going like, man, I can't tell if this is any good. I'm questioning myself a lot here, but I don't know. There was a little bit of obligation, I think, because those guys had made room for me, put their trust in me, so to speak. I kind of had to tell myself, you know, I just need to push through and just sing, do the best I can and trust that I'm in the hands of good people. I feel like I did. I found my voice. Thank you for thinking of me, and I'm glad to be there. Mim and I grew up out past Bemidji, so I'm looking forward to it.
Grand Rapids River Fest with Alan Sparhawk opening up, then Jeremy Albino, Margo Price, and Courtney Barnett. Get your tickets at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
Thank you for listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. It's 5:43. I'm Jennifer Barr. We can expect mostly sunny skies today, highs in the upper 70s, slight chance for showers and thunderstorms, and mostly cloudy tonight, lows in the upper 50s, again, slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Better chance for showers tomorrow with partly sunny skies, highs in the upper 60s to low 70s. There is more ahead from Morning Edition here on People Powered KAXE.
Green Cheese listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know, we listen to this Green Cheese and all the other programming on the stations. We really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can. Ever since you left.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local. And given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
It would be so boring.
This is the queen, and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org.
The station. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. You may think of Labor Day as the very end of the dog days of summer. That was a dad joke. Because this is a story of summer wiener dog races. The events featuring dachshunds are known as Doxy Derbies. And Matthew Holding Eagle III of Minnesota Public Radio is on it.
83 competitors from across the nation were in Burgess, Minnesota for the race. They were wiener dogs of all different shapes and sizes, from purebred sausage-shaped dachshunds with short or long hair to mixed breeds crossed with Chihuahua, Cocker Spaniel, or some other stubby-legged canine. And then there's Big Mac, named after the sandwich. The 16-pound dachshund is from Fargo, North Dakota.
He miraculously won last year. I'm hoping he repeats. I'm feeling the adrenaline already. It hasn't even started yet.
That's Devlin Cummings Paws, Big Mac's owner. He says the competition is a yearly quest for the pair. Before the race begins, the dogs do practice runs on the 90-foot straight line track. Flava Flav, named after the famous rapper, is off to a slow start. His handlers, the father-daughter team of Steve and Willa Larson, cheer him on.
Go! Go, Flav! Well, straight, not a bad practice run. I think there's more in them, but I thought that was a good training first start.
Ready, set, go!
Once the races start, the true art of wiener dog racing begins, because wiener dogs have a mind of their own. Sometimes they race, and sometimes they just want to get petted by spectators. During the preliminary rounds, seven wieners line up at the starting line with their handlers. Another handler waits as a catcher at the finish line. Both team members implement a multitude of methods to bribe the panting athletes. Sometimes they use squeaky toys, shaking treats, and other times just good old-fashioned separation anxiety. One owner goats her dog to find its dad at the finish line.
Go get dad.
Oliver, Annie, and Finley.
You're gonna go get him.
And our 2025 grand champion, Smokey.
When the first settles about 2 hours later, Big Mac gets usurped by veteran runner Smokey, a dachshund mix. His owners, Bane and Katie Abrahamson, from Thief River Falls, Minnesota, say the new champ spent his morning chasing birds to prepare for the victory.
That's pretty exciting because this is his third year, so the other years he's too scared, you know, other dogs and stuff, he gets scared and try to jump the fence or whatever. And this year, I guess he's used to it now when he just took off, and so we had pretty high hopes because we knew he was fast, but it all depended on how he acted around the other dogs and stuff.
As for Big Mac, Cummings Paws says the little dog was taking the loss in stride.
Good for him. He doesn't care about winning or losing. He just wants to take a nap and eat food. So we're going to go do that.
But next year, Big Mac and Smokey will be back, both cutting the mustard to decide who will be the top dog. For NPR News, I'm Matthew Holding Eagle III in Burgess, Minnesota.
Just wants to take a nap and eat food. Does that describe you on this Labor Day? Labor Day also marks the end of summer blockbuster season. So this afternoon, and all things considered, Bob Mondello suggests movies to look for this fall. Listen in the NPR app or on a smart speaker or on this public radio station. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Join us Saturday, September 6th for Grand Rapids River Fest. I'm Jennifer Barr, and I am so excited for this year's lineup. Music starts at 3 o'clock with Alan Sparhawk, a prolific and versatile musician best known as the frontman of Low. His many side projects over the years reveal a musician unafraid to experiment. Then we'll hear Jeremy Albino. His songs are grounded in the gritty storytelling of classic country music propelled by the rhythms of old school R&B. And then Margot Price. She has something to say but nothing to prove, and in just a few solo albums she has cemented herself as a force in Americana music. We'll end our night with Courtney Barnett, one of Australia's most successful musical exports. She has played many festivals around the world, including Coachella, Bonnaroo, Lollapalooza, and now Grand Rapids River Fest. Find tickets and more info at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. See you September 6th.
Labor Day weekend ends the summer travel season, right?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
For Marketplace, I'm Nova Safa and for David Brancaccio. Let's talk summer travel. It's supposed to be peak tourism and was forecast to be slow this year. But on both points, there's surprising news. Joining me is Eileen Crowley. She tracks the transportation and hospitality industry at the audit and advisory firm Deloitte. Good morning.
Glad to be here.
Has the summer travel season turned out as we expected?
One of the biggest trends that we're seeing is that folks are actually taking more trips this summer and expected to. So, you know, the trips might be a little bit quicker and shorter. But again, that prioritization of leisure travel is continuing for Americans is what we're seeing.
So some signs of good news, but we are seeing some tweaks perhaps to summer travel plans for Americans. What have those tweaks been besides the shorter, maybe quicker trips?
You are definitely correct. I like to refer to our travelers this summer as more the budget conscious traveler, a little bit more frugal than perhaps in summers past. But they're doing, you know, less international trips. They're also thinking about spending less once they get to a destination. A number of our travelers that we surveyed actually are intending to travel after Labor Day, which typically has been the end of the, you know, summer-defined travel season. And many are doing that because of the, you know, shoulder season being perhaps a little bit less expensive and keeping in line with their budgets.
Yeah, and airlines alluded to this in their forecasts for the rest of the year, right? They're saying that they're seeing kind of the usually kind of heavy summer demand period kind of get instead kind of spread out and thinned out a bit and going and kind of spilling into the fall.
We took a look back to our survey results from 2022 about travel post-Labor Day, and there was about 12% of Americans that indicated they intended to take their marquee or biggest trip of the summer season after Labor Day. If you look at the results of our survey this year in 2025, that percentage is closer to 23%. So it's almost doubled in the last 3 years of our survey.
Considering kind of the shifting travel patterns and the expanding period of travel, what do you expect for the fall? Where are we headed?
I think you'll see, like I mentioned, more travelers post Labor Day. They are intending to stretch that summer season out in many regards to get maybe perhaps a better pricing, whether it's hotels or airfares. And depending upon how the economy continues to fare, you know, you could see some folks, or some of our American travelers, staying with family and friends, actually, versus paid lodging. Again, it all surrounds the theme of a more frugal traveler, especially if they're feeling less financially secure.
All right, Deloitte's Eileen Crowley, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And U.S. markets, by the way, are on holiday, closed for Labor Day.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. The Name Your Price tool provides a range of coverage options. Progressive.com. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And by Avalara, providing cloud-based solutions for businesses to manage property tax compliance. Learn more at avalara.com/property tax.
Millions of Americans have some form of criminal record, an arrest, charge, or conviction. That record can go on to limit access to housing, employment, and education, even if an offense is dismissed. While some states offer automatic record expungement for qualified individuals, others require a court petition, which can be both expensive and confusing. A new tech startup is looking to make record expungement less complicated with the assistance of artificial intelligence.
My name is Roger Roman, and I am the co-founder of Legalese. So my co-founder, Lawrence Blackman, he's a practicing attorney. You know, he would come with ideas about things that could be fixed, basically, in the legal system. And expungement was one that he kept coming back to. Like a true attorney, he was very persistent and convincing. And I started to help him build an MVP, which was our first model to help people basically go ahead and figure out if they were eligible, one, for an expungement, and then help them in terms of processing it. We built that MVP a couple of years ago, and we realized that there was something there. There was a huge gap in the market in this space. Early on, you know, we thought our ideal customer profile was of a certain demographic. You know, we had our preconceived notions about who this could help. But over time, we found that this problem transcends all economic levels. It transcends race. It transcends everything. We've had investors say, hey, you know, I needed an expungement similar to Lawrence, right? He's a state representative and attorney. He needed to get an expungement. We started in Mississippi, one, because Mississippi was perceived as a challenge to us early on in terms of their judicial system. There's still a lot of reliance on paper. In addition to that, my co-founder, Lawrence, is a practicing attorney there. He's barred. He's also a state representative, right? So we had a lot of insight into how things move with the courts. The incarceration rate and the people with criminal records in Mississippi is one of the highest in the country. Unfortunately, it was fertile ground to test out our model and to build it. To be completely honest, we felt that if we could make this work in Mississippi, it would be a lot easier to make it work in other states that might have a little more advanced judicial system and might be a little more adept to using technology to solve these issues. I might be a little biased, but, you know, I'm a big fan of AI. Maybe in 20 years when we're all slaves to, you know, some AI overlord, right? I might regret saying this, but today it just feels like a superpower. A lot of times I joke with my co-founders about it being similar to a calculator, right? You know, in school, we were told not to use a calculator because we had to learn how to do math ourselves. And, you know, we wouldn't always have access to a calculator. And here we are today with cell phones with calculators on them. And we pretty much have access to a calculator in every predicament. So I know there's a lot of fear around AI and the potential power it has. But I think used in the right space and used, you know, responsibly, it can really help a lot of people and even the playing fields in a lot of spaces.
That's Roger Roman of Legalese, and I'm Nova Safo with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXC.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Good morning. Thank you for tuning in. Coming up 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Weather today, mostly sunny. We do have a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms, highs in the upper 70s. For tonight, mostly cloudy with lows in the upper 50s.